Well, as I said, first of all, let me say how thankful that I am for the opportunity to come and to be able to speak with you all this evening. I've heard of WISE for a long time, and at least the 3 years that I've lived here. And there's all kinds of things you could say about WISE, you know, like when we drove up and there's a Lowe's, it's like, well, they finally wised up, they got a Lowe's. I mean, you guys just set yourself up for all kinds of little barbs like that just because of the name of the town. But it's really good to be able to be here, and I have been looking forward to it since Brother E.R. called me and asked me if I could participate in this, and I'm thankful for the opportunity to be able to do so. He mentioned that I am from the state of Ohio, which I am. I was born and raised in Ohio, left there when I was 18 years old, and I think I've been back to the state twice in the years that I have been around. And I was never a Buckeye fan because I happened to grow up in the period of time when Woody Hayes was the coach of the team. And if you know anything about college football back in the 1960s and the 1970s with Woody Hayes, he was a sorry rascal, and nobody really wanted to follow the Buckeyes unless you were just a diehard Ohio State fan, which I never was. I eventually became an Arkansas fan, and I guess I've kind of stuck with that throughout the years, and although looking down at Kingsport has been a real challenge because there's been a number of people that you would think would be pulling for Tennessee. Well, they don't. They actually pull for Alabama. There's more Alabama people there than, and folks, I'll tell you something, it really makes you sick after a while. No offense to the Alabama fans in the audience if you happen to be there. I know there's some back there because we have Jonathan, at least. probably more of an Auburn fan than he was Alabama. Well, I'm glad to be able to be here, and I want to talk to you tonight about what I think is indeed a legitimate issue, a legitimate concern the children of God experience. I'm assuming, and I think it's a safe assumption, that the majority of people in this assembly are Christians. And that being the case, then we understand and recognize the fact, as Brother E.R. mentioned, that living a life as a child of God, as a Christian, can be difficult. It can be challenging, and especially in this world in which we live today. The difficulties in this commitment oftentimes come from a variety of different sources. Like, for instance, it could very well be that we have the kind of conflicts that we often experience simply because of the fact that we decided we wanted to become a Christian. And by virtue of that fact, we have invited things into our lives that can make our lives sometimes quite complicated. Jesus made his disciples clearly understand that if you are going to follow me and you're going to serve me, then you need to anticipate that you're going to experience difficulties in your life. In the 15th chapter of John, for instance, beginning there in verse 18, Jesus said, "If the world hates you, know that it has hated me before it has hated you. If you were of the world would love you as its own. But because you are not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. Remember the word that I said to you, a servant is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will also persecute you. If they kept my word, they will also keep yours." And we know that they persecuted Jesus, so we should expect that if we are going to be followers of Christ, that there is going to be some of that happening in our lives. Paul told Timothy over in 2 Timothy 3, verse 12, that if anyone desires to live a godly life in Christ Jesus, to expect persecution that will come into their life. So that may be one of the sources of the challenges that we experience simply because we became Christians. They may also come as a result of behaviors and conduct that we are called upon to manifest that perhaps we're just not used to. The kind of behaviors that are to be becoming of a child of God, and yet it may very well be that the life we lived before we became a Christian was a life that carried with it an awful lot of behavior that is not what you would expect for a Christian to live. But now that we're Christians, we know that we're supposed to be living a certain way, and sometimes we're just not comfortable with that. And then on the other hand, it may come from behaviors and conduct that we are called upon to give up. Behaviors and conduct that perhaps we are used to, and that we are comfortable with. But now we can no longer live that way, because we are people who are called to be living the kind of life that would reflect the glory of God as it is seen particularly in Jesus. The Apostle Paul, over in the book of Colossians, in the third chapter, he speaks about this putting off of an old man and putting on a new man, and he expresses it beginning there in the fifth verse of this chapter, where he says, Put to death, therefore, what is earthly in you, sexual immorality, impurity, passion, evil desire, and covetousness, which is idolatry. On account of these, the wrath of God is coming. In these, you too once walked when you were living in them. But now you must put them all away. And then he goes on to list a great deal of the types of sinful behaviors that oftentimes people are very comfortable with. That's the kind of lifestyle that they have chosen to live before they became a Christian. But now that they're a Christian, they have to put those off. But then he goes on to say in verse 12, put on then, as God's chosen ones, holy and beloved, compassionate hearts, kindness, humility, meekness, and patience, bearing with one another, and if anyone has a complaint against another, forgiving each other as the Lord has forgiven you, so must you also forgive. And above all, you must put on the bond of love, or put on love, which binds everything together in perfect harmony. And it could very well be that we're just not used to that kind of lifestyle. To be patient, to be compassionate, to be kind, when all we have ever known is to be impatient and to not really care about people and to be the kind of folks that oftentimes just fly off the handle. Well, that makes it difficult to live a Christian life because here we are called to live behaviors that we may not be used to and put off behaviors that we are used to. And so it becomes challenging. And I think that one of the areas of our lives that we often find as a great source of difficulty in living and behaving as Christians is in our own faith itself. And what I mean by that is the fact that oftentimes we have faith, but mixed in with that faith is doubt or unbelief. Now, there are some people who would say that that's impossible. If you have truly been converted to Christ, and if you are one who has dedicated your life to Him, then you can never have a heart that is mixed with faith and doubt. They just cannot go together. And yet I'm suggesting to you that just the opposite is true. And I think that most, if not all, people experience this problem at least sometime in their life. It is what I believe can be called the struggle of faith. And that's what we're going to be talking about this evening, is this concept of the struggle of faith that the Apostle Paul particularly is going to be, or that we're going to look about in the Gospel of John and look at some observations that the Apostle Paul makes about this. But we will be looking in Mark's Gospel, Mark the 9th chapter, and you may be wanting to turn over there because this is where we're going to get the basis of our lesson this evening. But in this struggle of faith that I'm talking, we're going to be talking about tonight, I think that what we see in this is the concept that here it is that we have this belief in God, and yet we're trying to continue to develop, we're trying to continue to grow in our faith, to make sure that our faith is something that becomes very strong, but at the same time, it becomes vulnerable to the slightest things that may cause us to begin to question ourselves, to begin to question God, and sometimes to begin to question even our commitment to God. And when we experience this, for a child of God, it can be something that can be very traumatic. And traumatic because it begins to cause us to wonder about the relationship that we have with God in the first place. It begins to cause us to wonder about that commitment that we made perhaps years ago, and therefore it oftentimes will lead us even wondering that if the commitment we made to God is something that is really there in our lives, is it something that is really worthwhile? And if I even entertain that thought, does that mean then that I'm not a very good Christian? And so when it happens, we inevitably become anxious, we become fearful, and sometimes we even reach the point of tears because we begin to think within ourselves, well, I must not be a very good Christian after all. And if I was a good Christian, then I wouldn't have this struggle. So that's what we're going to talk about tonight. A very real struggle, but I would suggest to you that if we're all honest with ourselves, we will have to admit that we have gone through, but we don't like to talk about it. Because it demonstrates in our minds oftentimes a weakness in our faith. And yet I would say to you that it is something that all of us go through, and that if we are honest with ourselves, that we would admit that we have experienced it. Now, with that in mind, I want us to look at what is spoken here in Mark, the 9th chapter, beginning in the 14th verse, where we have a record of a man who had this struggle. And I want us to see how it is that he got through it. Beginning in verse 14, it says, "And when they came to the disciples, they saw a great crowd around them and scribes arguing with them. And immediately all the crowd, when they saw him, were greatly amazed and ran up to him and greeted him. And he asked them, 'What are you arguing about with them?' And someone from the crowd answered him, 'Teacher, I brought my son to you, for he has a spirit that makes him mute. And whenever it seizes him, it throws him down, and he foams and grinds his teeth and becomes rigid. So I asked your disciples to cast it out, and they were not able.' And he answered them, 'O faithless generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you? Bring him to me.' And they brought the boy to him, and when the spirit saw him, immediately it convulsed the boy, and he fell on the ground and rolled about, foaming at the mouth. And Jesus asked his father, 'How long has this been happening to him?' And he said, 'From childhood, and it is often cast him into the fire and into water to destroy him. But if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us.' And Jesus said to him, 'If you can, all things are possible for one who believes.' Immediately the father of the child cried out and said, 'I believe, help my unbelief.'" There are three things I want to talk to you about tonight. The first one is this, and that is the fact that what we see in this is the truth, that faith and unbelief oftentimes reside in the same heart. And that is exactly what we see here in verse 24. When this man says to Jesus, "I believe, help my unbelief." So he believes, and yet there is this doubt. This mixture of faith and this mixture of unbelief. This man had a son who was possessed of an evil spirit. And it did horrible things to him, as the context makes clear. And it's evident that this father knew what it was that Jesus was capable of doing. And apparently, he also had this knowledge, this understanding, that his disciples had the ability to be able to perform miracles too. And so with desperation, what he does first is he seeks help from the disciples who, for some reason, were unable to cast this evil spirit out. And there's an explanation for all of that that we're not going to get into. Matthew's gospel, perhaps, is more clear on this than even Mark's gospel. But nonetheless, they can't cast the demon out. And so it appears from the text that because the disciples failed in their effort to cast out the evil spirit, that this desperate father is now beginning to wonder, can Jesus even cast him out? And so he comes to him and asks him the question. He says, "But if you can do anything..." Now that's taken from the New King James Version of the Bible, and I like the way that that reads it, where he says, "If you can do anything..." And I think what we see from this is the fact that here is a man who began to wonder. He knew Jesus' reputation, otherwise why would he have come to him? He knew the disciples' reputation, and yet he saw the disciples couldn't do it. And I'm suggesting to you that perhaps he is manifesting some doubt in Jesus' ability to be able to do it as well. And so he says to him, "But if you can do anything..." And it was because of this statement that Jesus gives a mild rebuke to the father to teach him that the problem here is not in Jesus' power to do what was asked of him, but it is in the father's lack of faith. Now, what is interesting to me is that if you look at this text and you compare different versions of the Bible as it translates these words, one of the things that you begin to learn is that there's a great deal of ambiguity in what Jesus' response is here in this 23rd verse, when he says to him, "If you can, all things are possible for one who believes." If you use the New King James Version, you will notice that it says, "If you can believe, all things are possible." And so there is that ambiguity in the original language. Now, what most modern translations will say is something like what we see here in the English Standard Version, where it actually translates this, "If you can." You will notice that that's in quotation marks. In other words, what he's doing is he's repeating the father. The father says, "If you can do anything." And it's like Jesus is incredulous. "What do you mean if I can do this? What are you talking about?" And that seems to be the idea when he says, "If you can." It's like, somebody tells you something, some kind of a statement, and you're just a guest at that, what in the world do you mean by that? That's kind of like what Jesus is saying. I like the way that the Net Bible actually translates this, when it actually puts it in the form of a question. And the translators will translate this by saying, if you are able, in other words, the man comes to him and says, if you're able, will you do this for me? And Jesus says, if you're able? What do you mean if you're able? Now, we can go on and on talking about the nature of the text and the ambiguity that is in it, but I do believe that it is clear that what we see in this is the fact that Jesus has no doubt of his ability to be able to cast this demon out of this boy. The doubt was in the mind of the father, even though he came to Jesus believing that Jesus could heal his son. And I think it's important to note that if the father didn't have faith in Jesus at all, then he never would have come to him in the first place. And yet, if he had perfect faith, then he would have come with a different attitude, and he wouldn't have used the words that he used by questioning Jesus' ability to be able to do this. Therefore, I believe what we see here in the heart of this man is this mixture of faith and unbelief. He is having a struggle, and it's a struggle of faith. How often is it that our walk with God is characterized as hearts in which there is both faith and unbelief? We have come to him in faith. We have accepted his magnificent grace that he has shown to us in the giving of his son. And we come to walk with him because of the faith that we have in him. And yet, there are times in which we question him, times in which we question his ways. And perhaps it may be by wondering if the way he leads us is maybe it's just too demanding, that he's expecting too much from me. Or perhaps it's by wondering if he really is all that powerful after all. And if he really is all that powerful, and if he really does care, then why is it that I have this struggle in the first place? And why is it that when I have horribly failed in living the kind of life that I know I should be living, that I feel so bad about myself, and I feel horrible guilt? And that's the struggle that we experience. That's the conflict that we oftentimes see within ourselves. And it is when this unbelief manifests itself that we are shaken in our faith, and we begin losing our joy in being Christians in the first place. And perhaps we may even begin to wonder, am I really a Christian at all? Our intent is not to leave the Lord, because we know that there's no one else that we could go to. But yet, by the same token, the joy and the happiness that we once experienced, it's not there anymore. We're lacking that. Even though we might think we're alone in this, I think what we need to understand is that we're not alone. Most Christians, if not all Christians, go through this at some point in their life. And others have experienced it. And what that means is that others have overcome it. And so can we. One man I was reading after put it this way. He said, this combination is very true to nature. There are degrees of faith even in the faithful. Where is perfect faith in Jesus, who has not had reason to cry, help thou mine unbelief, increase my faith? And so we see, therefore, what is the reality of what is a very common, contradictory phenomenon in the lives of children of God, and that is faith and unbelief oftentimes residing in the same heart. Which brings me to our second point, and that is this. And when faith and unbelief meet, there is a war that goes on. Over in the book of James, in the first chapter, James speaks about this war, this conflict that we experience in faith and in the lack of faith. James chapter 1, beginning there in verse 5, James says, if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask God, who gives generously to all without reproach, and it will be given him. But let him ask in faith, with no doubting. For the one who doubts is like a wave of the sea that is driven and tossed by the wind. For that person must not suppose that he will receive anything from the Lord. He is a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways. Now, read this text because of the fact that we cannot be simply content with the understanding that faith and unbelief residing in the same heart is a common problem. It's good that we know that, because I really do believe that when children of God, in fact, I believe this in just about anything, that when people are going through hard times, recognize that somebody else has gone through what I am experiencing right now, and they have overcome it, then that gives me great hope that I can overcome it. And so when children of God go through this conflict of faith and unbelief in their hearts and realize that other people have gone through this too as well and they've overcome it, then that helps us out. But it is more than simply having this understanding that there is this common problem that oftentimes is a part of the life of the Christian. And it may make us feel better to know that we are not alone in this, but it really doesn't take care of the problem. And so that's what we have to pay attention to. We have to be able to try to somehow reconcile this and somehow figure out how it is that in the midst of this conflict, we can resolve it. This problem is one that is serious, and particularly is that true if it's not addressed. Now, in the context of this passage in James chapter 1, James has, in fact, been discussing the trials of life. And, in fact, he gives us what is one of the great paradoxes in the Scriptures, and that is, he says, count it all joy, my brothers, when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. Count it all joy when you're going through trials. That's a paradox. How in the world can somebody who's going through severe trials in their life turn around and thank God for it? Well, that can be done. It is a paradox. But it is something that can be done. Count it all joy, he said, when you fall into these trials of life. And he refers to them as tests of our faith. And when they are used correctly, they will help us to come out on the other side of this with an unswerving constancy, which is the basis of all other virtues. And so as he says here in this third verse, for you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness, and let steadfastness have its full effect, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. Now, in order to be able to perceive our trials from that perspective, and in order to be able to allow God to use those trials in this way for our good, we first of all have to have the proper wisdom that enables us to do so. And it is a wisdom that does not come from man, but it is a wisdom that comes from God. And that is something, therefore, that we must ask for. Because if we think that we're just simply naturally going to come by this understanding that I need to count it all joy when I go through these various trials, that's never going to happen. The only way it's going to happen is when we ask God to give us the wisdom. In order to be able to get this wisdom, there are two things that have to be remembered. Number one is how God gives. And God gives, he says, lovingly and generously. And the second thing that also has to be taken into consideration is how we are supposed to ask. And the way we are supposed to ask is without doubt. Now, it is in the section of how the asker is to be asking God for this wisdom that we learn about the seriousness of this war. The seriousness between this conflict that is in a Christian, this faith and this unbelief. When there is both faith and unbelief in a person's heart, he's a person who is described here very graphically as one who is not very happy. And that's to put it mildly. But he's just not a happy person. That's all. He is described here as like a wave of the sea driven and tossed by the wind. One man described this as like a fishing bobber or a floater. I don't know what you call them in this part of the country. We call them bobbers where I grew up. When we moved to Arkansas, they called them floaters. But it's a little thing that you toss out there, and it's out there waiting for a fish to hit it. You know, you got a fish on the line. Well, have you ever had that floater cut from the rod? You can't get to it. And what does it do? It just kind of sits out there and floats around. And if the wind blows, it'll blow it into shore where there's some kind of a foundation. And the wind blows the other direction and blows it back out there where there is no foundation. And that's the way one man described this. You're near the shore, and then you're far away. Another man described this as like a drunken man staggering on the road from side to side, getting nowhere. He is like a wave of the sea, driven and tossed by the wind. He is referred to as a double-minded man. And this word for double-minded, it's an interesting word in the original language. It's a word that literally means a man with two souls inside of him, or two minds inside of himself. One mind believes, the other mind disbelieves. And thus the man literally becomes a walking civil war. He is trusting, and he is doubting. Trusting the Lord and doubting the Lord at the same time. And so he is waging a continual battle inside of himself. And it's easy to see why a heart that has both faith and unbelief residing in it at the same time creates such unhappiness, particularly in light of this metaphor of a war in which he talks about this conflict that is going on. And when we view it from that perspective, whoever is happy when a war is going on? It doesn't matter whether you're actually involved in it or if you're outside observing it. The fact of the matter is nobody likes a war. And here we are, folks. Sometimes we are walking civil wars. The faith and the unbelief fighting with one another. And when you look at this father in Mark's account over here in Mark chapter 9, do you see a man who is as far away from happiness as he could possibly get? He is crying. He is crying to Jesus. And he is weeping, saying, I believe you. Help my unbelief. Whichever mind in this double-mindedness that we experience is going to win is going to be determined by the side that is ultimately taken. And I will tell you this, that ultimately the side will be taken. It is inevitable. The combatants in a war all desire peace. And that is true whether you're the good guy or you're the bad guy. However you perceive that, everybody wants peace. Nobody likes a war. And sooner or later, peace in such a conflict is going to be achieved. But who is going to win? Will it be the good guys, or will it be the bad guys? Well, in this civil war of double-mindedness that we experience, whether it be faith that wins or whether it be unbelief that wins, it is going to be determined by whose side we ultimately take. We want to be on the right side, don't we? We want to be on faith's side. But I want to tell you something. We cannot do that by ourselves. It's impossible. And that's why this man said to Jesus, I believe, Lord, help my unbelief. Which brings me to the final point that I want to share with you tonight. And that is, the sure way to win this war is to call in the help of Jesus. This man, as he was rebuked by Jesus, who with incredulity says to the man, if you may, if you have the power, if you are capable, if you're able, and he says to him, if you believe, it can be done. Jesus knew what he was capable of doing. Now what Jesus is trying to do is to convince this man what Jesus is capable of doing. And so this man says to Jesus, Lord, I believe. Help my unbelief. I want you to notice some key things about this. First of all, this man did not wait for his faith to become stronger. In other words, it wasn't until he had more assurance and more encouragement given to him that Jesus could really heal his son that he came to Jesus. He came with what faith that he had. And what we see here is a man who, in essence, is pleading for his life because he is pleading for the life of his child. And so, hating his unbelief, he struggles against it. He comes to Jesus, even though his faith is weak. But his faith is there. And his appeal is to the only one who can help him. And that is to Jesus himself. And I think we see here a magnificent example that all who hear the good news of Jesus can learn some things about and learn some things from. But especially, I think what we see with respect to the idea of this example is that those who are penitent, those who are tempted, those who are doubting, Jesus is the solution. You just turn to him because he's there to help. When we experience the emotional pain and the emotional suffering in our souls of faith and unbelief residing in the same heart, when we go through this civil war, then the only one who can assure us of victory in this conflict, and the only one who can receive, who can assure us of peace, and I'm talking about true peace, the only one who can do this is Jesus. And that's why he says to him, Lord, I believe, help my unbelief. And what is so wonderful is that we know, first of all, let me say, we know this intellectually. We know it from the scriptures. We know that he is there for us, and he will supply us what we need, because we know that he knows our weaknesses, and we know that he knows our needs better than we know them ourselves. And the reason why we know that intellectually is because that's what the Bible says, and we believe the Bible. And so we look at passages like Hebrews chapter 2, verses 16 through 18, where the Hebrew writer here addresses this confidence that we can have in Christ because of what it is that he did for us, and so we can therefore have confidence in him that he will continue to do these things for us in building our faith. As he says here in verse 16, for surely it is not angels that he helps, but he helps the offspring of Abraham. Therefore, he had to be made like his brothers in every respect, so that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in the service of God to make propitiation for the sins of the people. For because he himself has suffered being tempted, he is able to help those who are being tempted. Or Hebrews chapter 4, beginning in verse 14, where there he says, since then we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession, for we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who is in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us then, with confidence, draw near to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. Or a passage like what Peter said in 1 Peter chapter 5, verses 6 and 7. Humble yourselves, therefore, into the mighty hand of God, so that at the proper time he may exalt you, casting all your anxieties upon him because he cares for you. Intellectually, we all understand that. But there are many in this assembly, I'm sure, there has to be, who not only understand this intellectually, but they've experienced it. And if you've experienced this, then you have a greater advantage than those who just intellectually have got it in their brain. Because until you experience this, you will never truly understand the kind of peace that Jesus can bring to our hearts when our hearts are filled with this conflict of faith and unbelief. It is to Jesus that we must turn, because he is the one who gives us the ability to win this civil war, so that faith conquers, so that faith is the victory, as we have sung about this evening. And so in the meantime, our desire should be to continue to follow his guidance. We should seek to do his will, and we should seek to do it even when we don't feel like it. Have you ever been like that? I just don't feel like doing this. Do it anyway. Even when you don't feel like doing it, do it. Because he's always there for us. And he's always there to help our unbelief. Faith, by the very nature of what it is, as the Hebrew writer said in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 1, it is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Faith is a struggle. It's not something that comes naturally. And the reason why I say that is because by nature, what we want to do is we want to see everything. We want to know everything. We want to know it right now. We want the empirical evidence. We want things that we can reach out and touch. We want things that we can see with our eyes. We want, naturally, to see everything and know everything right now. And that's not the nature of faith. Faith is the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things that are not seen. Faith must be cultivated. And the only way that it can be done is by the spiritual discipline and by the devotion that we give to Jesus. And to discipline ourselves is not an easy task, and especially is that true when we're looking at that which we cannot see. And that is the struggle of faith. I can't see it, but I know it's there. I know it's there. Because the Bible tells me it's there, and because faith, by its very nature, is that evidence of things that is not seen. And so it's a struggle. It's a struggle that I go through. It's a struggle that you go through. It's a struggle that all Christians go through. We are all at different levels of our development and our faith with the Lord. But one of these days, faith will become sight. And no longer will we have that struggle. But in the meantime, we'll struggle. But we need to understand that in that struggle, in that conflict, that the one who's going to win is the one whose side we take. And we need to understand that this is a conflict that we cannot afford to lose. It has eternal consequences. And so when we experience it, like the father who came to Jesus with both faith and unbelief residing in his heart, the only way we're going to win this is by calling in the help of the Lord. And we will say, as probably we have said, at least in our own way, Lord, I believe, help my unbelief. And I hope that that helps us in this struggle of faith to be victors. Now, if you're in the assembly tonight and you're not yet a Christian, we're going to sing a song of encouragement to encourage you to become a child of God and to join us in what is a struggle, but it's a struggle that is worth it. Because ultimately, in the end, you will find the great reward that God has given, is giving to those who are his people. And you will also find that in the midst of the struggle, you will have everything you need to get through the difficulties, the trials, the challenges of life that life throws at us. But we will be people who, in the end, on the other side of it, we will be the stronger because our faith is in Jesus Christ. So come join us in the struggle. Come walk with us. Come walk with the Lord if you believe Jesus is God's Son. Repent of your sins. Confess your faith and be baptized. Let us help you in whatever way you can. Let's come as together we stand and sing.